Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Atwasage. Mattawa First Nations in northwestern Ontario are wondering why they haven't been consulted about mining activities in their territory, the area known as the Ring of Fire. The Tribal Wichewewin Capital Corporation is another step closer in its application for a judicial review of a $15.5 million federal government Aboriginal loan guarantee program. The Nunavut Ngavik Corporation says they've begun strategizing to optimize economic benefits from the new sealing agreement between Canada and China. And the federal government of Status of Women Committee have been traveling around the country researching violence against Aboriginal women, and we'll hear some of those findings later on in Bombsida. And the Director General of Aboriginal Entrepreneurship at Indian and Northern Affairs Canada discusses her work from supporting major projects to supporting small and medium businesses. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Chiefs in northwestern Ontario are not happy about continued developments in the area known as the Ring of Fire. In a press release, the nine Mattawa First Nations chiefs question why they have not been consulted about decisions that impact their communities. The leaders say there are close to 100 mining companies that have staked claims in the Ring of Fire. Several Mattawa communities have been raising concerns about the impacts of exploration and mining in their territory for a number of years. Raymond Ferris is the mining advisor for Mattawa First Nations. He says First Nations want to be more involved in the planning, but are also at a financial disadvantage.
Well, they're looking at they want to conduct a lot of due diligence, mainly looking at what is going to happen out there, and they haven't been provided with any sort of funding, somewhat for anything for legal or technical point of view, so that they can have somebody to come and look at what the plans are and determine what's gonna happen in the future. Like I mentioned, that there has been no exploration agreements done, other than exploration companies coming in there and developing a draft exploration agreement. But you know, the First Nations are at a disadvantage when work is carried on and trying to negotiate an agreement at the same time.
However, leaders have also said they don't oppose responsible development in communities, and leaders also say they recognize potential benefits for their communities and Northern Ontario. A diary written more than 100 years ago could clinch treaty negotiations for the Meshkegawut Council in Ontario. The diary belonged to government official Daniel McMartin. Meshkegawut Council lawyer Murray Klippenstein told the North Bay Nugget the recently uncovered diary suggests First Nation leaders may have been misled by government negotiators in the signing of Treaty No. 9. Klippenstein says there's a conflict between what's in the diary and what's in the signed treaty document. Mining activity has been picking up in the Ring of Fire area, with the largest mining discovery of a large deposit of chromite. And Klippenstein says the government is relying on the perception that it has the authority to seize land, and that authority, according to Klippenstein, was never discussed in McMartin's diary. The sealing agreement between Canada and China will help open doors for the Inuit. Kathy Tautangi, president of the Nunavut Tungavik Incorporation, says they've begun strategizing to optimize economic benefits.
This sealing agreement has no end date. It calls for a 5-year review of the agreement. And China, as you know, as Canadians are aware, has a huge market. And this will give time for the Inuit to develop edible seal products and to develop other types of items that we use to survive economically in Nunavut. And for our part, because we derive our income from the sale of pelts and products, we are very optimistic about it. And at this time, we need to develop strategies within 5 years to 10 years to make sure we start earning from our seal products.
Under the agreement, Canada is the only country permitted to export edible seal products to China. Other than seal meat, Tautangi says edible seal products include delicacies like seal flipper and liver. She says seal oil is also often used to soften hands. Tautangi says they'll also be working on translating Inuit recipes to Chinese. She adds the seal population is very healthy at 1.2 million. Members of Raza River First Nation have been deliberating a possible $80 million payout to the reserve from Ottawa. Band members from the Southern Manitoba community gathered in Winnipeg January 15th. Community members were voting on a tentative land claim settlement. The Winnipeg Sun reports the settlement would compensate the community for its concerns about land being taken away following an 1871 treaty. If the settlement is ratified by membership, each member could also receive $5,000. Chief Terry Nelson told media the settlement is a way to help the reserve of more than 1,400 residents gain compensation for an injustice. RCMP in Alberta are looking for the owner of some First Nation artifacts. CBC reports Okotoks RCMP have received what appears to be a war lance and a spear. Police say the items were handed into them after being found in a dumpster. The items are in good condition and decorated with leather and beadwork. Police say if the owner of the items is not located, they will unfortunately be destroyed. The Federal Government of Status of Women Committee has just wrapped up its visit to Aboriginal organizations in the country's north. The committee is gathering interviews for its study into violence against Aboriginal women. Vancouver Centre MP Hedy Fry is the chair of the committee. She says they've been finding there are high levels of domestic violence in Aboriginal communities. Hedy says they've also heard that root causes include residential school issues, colonization, and historical trauma. And she says although the committee has wrapped up its visits throughout the country, it will keep the door open to hear more presentations.
We found that there are so many people who want to present that we may have to go back to them, to Ottawa, and then do some more Ottawa hearings where people who were not able to come when we were doing our trips across the country would want to come to Ottawa and tell us other things that they feel we may need to hear. So we may, I don't know, but we were hoping that it would be, you know, done within the next 3 months.
She also hopes the report, including recommendations, will be tabled in the House of Commons within the next 3 months. A bursary is being set up in memory of Tim McLean. The 22-year-old was the young man who was beheaded on a Greyhound bus. CBC reports the Manitoba government is setting up the Tim McLean Memorial Bursary Fund to provide money to Aboriginal students enrolled in trade apprenticeship programs. McLean was killed near Portage-la-Prairie in 2008. Also, according to CBC, Vince Lee, the man who killed him, is being held indefinitely in a psychiatric hospital. Alberta Premier Ed Selmack still hasn't visited the community of Fort Chipewyan downstream from the oil sands. The Edmonton Journal reports the Premier made a public promise last October to visit the community. And it's been more than 3 months since a group of university students presented Selmack with a round-trip ticket to the community, and he still hasn't booked a flight nor set aside time for travel. A spokesperson for the Premier told the Edmonton Journal that Selmack has not arranged his trip yet because he's waiting for a letter of intent from a local leader, as the Premier has not been invited by the community. Stelmack wanted the Athabasca Chipewyan Chief Alan Adam to sign a letter of intent, which outlines a framework for dialogue and collaborative action. Meanwhile, Chief Adam told the newspaper that Stelmack doesn't need to be invited to hear what people are saying, and he will not be signing the letter. Chief Adam calls the framework a public relations campaign for the Premier's office. The Tribal Wiche-Waywin Capital Corporation is moving forward with its application for a judicial review of a federal Aboriginal loan guarantee program. TWCC's spokesperson Gord McIntosh says the federal program has been unfair since the government gave $15.5 million in loan guarantees to non-Aboriginal banks and credit unions to subsidize loans to First Nation businesses.
We're talking here about a badly designed program, however well-intentioned. I mean, this is a program that gives subsidies in the form of loan guarantees to non-Aboriginal banks and credit unions in order to encourage lending to Aboriginal business. Okay, we don't have a problem with encouraging seed capital to finance Aboriginal business, but for the past 20 years, there have been Aboriginal financial institutions doing this mission. And now that something's starting to get going in the Aboriginal economy, it seems very unfair to simply hand it to mainstream lenders after the Aboriginal financial institutions have blazed a trail and started this.
It's been over 1 year since WCC, a Winnipeg-based Aboriginal financial institution, went to court to stop the subsidies. Last fall, the court ordered the government to disclose all documents related to the Aboriginal Loan Guarantee Program. A new series on APTN about First Nations life is garnering quite a bit of media attention. The television show is called Blackstone and stars actors such as Gordon Tootoosis, Carmen Moore, and Andy Fraser. Carmen Moore told media that the program will probably ruffle a lot of feathers, but at the same time, there will be a lot of relief that someone's finally saying something. Blackstone shows band politics at its worst and will frequently revolve around the embezzlement of federal funds. Although the series focuses on messy situations on reserve, Blackstone's producer Ron Scott says the series carries a central message of a more positive future. Blackstone premieres on APTN January 25th and Showcase on January 28th. And that's your National Aboriginal News. Burnt Project 1 with Rebel Groove. Mattawa First Nations in northwestern Ontario are getting pretty upset because they say they haven't been consulted or included in any of the mining exploration activities that have been happening in their traditional territory, which is also known as the Ring of Fire. Here's Raymond Ferris, mining advisor for the Mattawa First Nations.
Well, first of all, I guess that there's a lot of exploration activity that's happening up there, and the First Nations are trying to get some sort of exploration agreements before any activity happens. That should have been done right from the very beginning. And because these agreements are very important to determine what the First Nations want in that area and how that agreement could be implemented through things like environmental issues or environmental impacts that these camps may have, such as camps being too close to the water, and the First Nations could put in that agreement that they should be a certain amount of feet from the or meters from the lake, or these fuel barrels should be stored in that place. So all these things need to be put in there rather than after the fact when the First Nations see that, then they have no way other than to, what it causes is some confusion, and it causes First Nations and the industry to break down in working out their relationships.
Okay, so and other than environmental allowances, what else are First Nations looking for?
Well, they're looking at they want to conduct a lot of due diligence, mainly looking at what is going to happen out there, and they haven't been provided with any sort of funding, somewhat for anything for legal or technical point of view, so that they can have somebody to come and look at what the plans are and to determine what's gonna happen in the future. Like I mentioned, that there has been no exploration agreements done, other than exploration companies coming in there and developing a draft exploration agreement. But you know, the First Nations are at disadvantage while work is carried on and trying to negotiate an agreement at the same time.
Okay, and as far as that goes, which companies are in the area? Exploring.
Oh, there's many, but I think the main ones would be Cliffs Natural Resources, who bought out the Spider Resource last summer, and then there's Noront. So those are the ones I'm well aware of that are in that area. And Cliffs, I guess, is the major player that's probably going to open up the north through the infrastructure that could be developed. That will open up the north.
How have the First Nations been lobbying or advocating for inclusion?
Well, they've been, they've been sending out some letters, and they've spoken to Minister Gravel, and they met with, in fact, three ministers, MNR Minister, MND, MNF, Minister Gravel, and Minister of Aboriginal Affairs. That was back last fall, and they said that they were determined to do something about it, but up to this point they haven't, and the First Nations are getting a bit upset, I guess, as to some of these media releases that are going out, and I know Cliffs is doing project description is going to be coming out, they said, sometime this month, and the furnace or the smelter is going to be determined as to where it's going to be at. So the First Nations haven't been included in those decisions, and it's as far as, and that's part of their building up that relationship and part of consultation and accommodation with the First Nations, is to give them that information and help them determine, help the First Nations to work out a relationship in partnership with the industry to make those decisions.
Okay, and can you tell me why it's important for First Nations to be consulted and or included in those decisions?
Well, it's not only is it these are coming out of Supreme Court decisions, but this is what our people have felt all this time. They see it in the south where forestry has devastated their traplands, where they had a right to make a living, and our rights are protected under Treaty Number 9, which our First Nations have signed, and out of that flows the consultation accommodation agreements that obligations, I guess, from the government before they can infringe or impact on First Nations lands or their trapping areas or their land use areas. Then they must consult. You know, these are protected under the treaty and the Constitution of Canada.
And in addition to that, I also understand that there have been amendments to Ontario's Mining Act with respect to consulting and accommodating Aboriginal people, as well as a dispute resolution mechanism in there. And aren't any of those being put to use in the territory?
Well, the First Nations, the Mining Act has gone through despite the First Nations objections. And I think our First Nations position is that, you know, our treaty and Aboriginal rights will supersede any piece of legislation or what have you with what the province is doing, and everything will come out of any kind of agreements that the First Nations have with industry and the government, and in there they will put all their dispute resolutions or what have you inside that agreement, rather than following the Mining Act, because the Mining Act is, as far as we can see, our rights are supersede that, and we don't want to lower ourselves to pieces of legislation that will impact our rights.
Okay, and what will happen if First Nations aren't meaningfully consulted or included by industry and government?
Well, I can't speak on behalf of the First Nations, but I'm sure that they will intervene in some way that they will have to be listened to, and that they will be participants in a true and meaningful fashion. That this development will come in a way where relationship will be built upon trust, honesty, and those kind of principles. And after all, these projects will require the consent of our people.
That was Raymond Ferris, a mining advisor for the Mattawa First Nations. The Federal Government Status of Women Committee has been traveling throughout Canada, speaking with representatives from Aboriginal organizations. The committee passed a motion last spring to undertake a study on the violence against Aboriginal women, and the study has been underway since last April. And it began with three meetings in Ottawa with national Aboriginal organizations, government departments, and other stakeholders. Over the summer, the committee conducted fact-finding visits to the country's north and east coast, and the committee has now just wrapped up visits in the country's north. Vancouver Centre MP Hedy Fry is the chair of the Status of Women Committee.
The committee unanimously agreed, which means that all the four political parties, so members of the committee, all unanimously agreed that the issue of violence against Aboriginal women was a very important one. It was a priority with the report coming out of Sisters in Spirit last year, which talked about the 580 missing and murdered women. Many people had been hoping there would be a public inquiry, and since there wasn't one, we felt that it was important for Parliament to pay attention to what is an extraordinarily and abnormal amount of violence against Aboriginal women that's been going on for quite a while, and that given the best intentions of all levels of government, it still has not been able to deal with this issue. So we felt that it was important for us to talk to Aboriginal communities, to police, to other levels of government, to see what was happening, what was working, what should work, and to look at the root causes of this violence against Aboriginal women, to look at the nature of the violence against Aboriginal women, and what types of violence, is it domestic, societal, systemic, what are they, and what are the ways we can deal with them, what's the best way to find a way to put an end to the violence, and to prevent it in the long term.
Yeah, that's a pretty big task, and So far you've been traveling around, and I know that this initiative started last spring, and what are some of the things that you've been finding so far?
We've been finding out some very common problems. We've been finding out there's a high level of family violence, domestic violence of all kinds within Aboriginal communities. We're finding that there's a high level of societal violence outside of Aboriginal communities, and that means in urban areas where people have left the reserve and gone to live in urban areas. We're finding that women specifically are targets of the domestic violence, and that in fact women and men are the targets of societal violence outside in urban areas. The high levels of addiction, high levels of prostitution, high levels of illness, mental illness, etc., that are occurring as a result of this. So we found out what the problems are. We're trying to find out what are the ways in which to deal with it. And the root causes, we have heard very clearly, come from a residential school, come from colonialization, come from very long and historic fact that Aboriginal people have been fragmented as a society and as families, so that basically they don't have any structures anymore that many other communities have, and that rebuilding community structure, rebuilding community sense of community is key. Rebuilding families and working with men in cases of domestic violence are as important. We're hearing that family-centered solutions are really key and important, especially on reserve. And that we're finding that there is very little infrastructure, we're hearing from people, to deal in the cities, for instance, with places for them to live, with housing, abilities for them to keep their children being taken away from women being afraid to report domestic abuse because somebody would take their children away. So there's just a multiplicity of factors. Now, this is what we're hearing. What we will decide as a committee are the ways to deal with it. We're hearing some pretty strong examples of best practices in certain places where there will be some group or some NGO or some member of government doing some extraordinary work that is resulting in very good outcomes. So, you know, we're compiling that. I can't tell you what the committee will decide. I can't tell you what the committee's report will say, I'm just telling you what we heard.
Okay, and I know that usually with studies and reports like this, there are recommendations, and will you be looking for recommendations also from the Aboriginal community?
We write the report, and we put the recommendations in it. That report is to be tabled in the House of Commons for all members of Parliament and for the whole of the House of Commons to look at. Specifically, the government of the day will have to respond to that report and its recommendations within 90 days. So at the end of the day, after that report is tabled, it will depend on political will of the particular government of the day to do something about it.
And when do you expect the report to be tabled?
I don't know. We found that there are so many people who want to present that we may have to go back to them, to Ottawa, and then do some more Ottawa hearings, where people who were not able to come when we were doing our trips across the country would want to come to Ottawa and tell us other things that they feel we need to hear. So we may, I don't know, but we were hoping that it will be, you know, done within the next 3 months.
That was Vancouver Centre MP Hedy Fry, chair of the Status of Women Committee. Now here's Inez with Breathe.
You wanna know, really though, we need a lot of progression. And for you, I'm an addict, asthmatic, breathes out of the question. You got me dizzy, straight seeing stars. Yo, Inez, I think I need CPR.
Tungavikan Corporation is looking forward to the economic opportunities for the Inuit through the new sealing agreement between Canada and China. The sealing agreement was reached earlier this month. Here's Kathy Tautangi, the president of NTI.
I'm really pleased with that, and I applaud the government of Canada for coming to an agreement. At this time, while we speak, the European Union had imposed a ban on imports of Canadian seal products in 2009. And Inuit had to look for markets outside of the EU. So this agreement will enable the Inuit to strategize and make a livelihood of the seal up in the Arctic.
What kind of hardships did the EU ban cause for the Inuit?
That hardship is with the high cost of living, and to make, when we buy non-traditional food, we subsist from our traditional food economy, But from the seal skin, we produce clothing and we produce other types of items such as wallets, purse, beautiful items that we sell. And from our sales, families survive from the economic sale of these seal products.
Okay, and how would the sealing agreement with China help?
This sealing agreement has no end date. It calls for a 5-year review of the agreement, and China, as you know, as Canadians are aware, has a huge market, and this will give time for the Inuit to develop edible seal products and to develop other types of items that we use to survive economically in Nunavut. And for our part, because we derive our income from the sale of pelts and products, we are very optimistic about it. And at this time, we need to develop strategies within 5 years, 10 years, to make sure we start earning from our seal products.
And forgive my ignorance, but other than seal meat, what are edible seal products?
Okay, other than seal meat, animal seal products that are delicacies, like the flippers are a delicacy, the liver, and seal oil is often used to soften sometimes hands. And we need to develop a cookbook, possibly in the Chinese language, so we can introduce our type of exotic food that we have in Nunavut and introduce it to the market in China. And we are very positive that outside of the European ban, Inuit will benefit from this agreement, and we really are looking forward within 5 to 10 years to see how we can develop and strategize in order to benefit from this Canadian agreement.
That sounds really great, a Chinese language cookbook. And how is the seal population over there?
The seal population of ring seals, I asked for statistics, is 1.2 million. It's very healthy. Currently, Nunavut, we make $800,000 a year on it, and that's from our products alone. If you come to Nunavut, you will see beautiful seal coats, beautiful wallets, pack sacks, and placemats, and hairpins. And it's amazing. We are very creative, and we often, and as you know, Jennifer, Inuit are very, their carvings are already in demand right around the world. And now with China's market being open for us by the government of Canada and the government of Nunavut, we can produce, and we take pride in what we produce. We don't want to be recipients of the system. We want to be a very productive Inuit population in Nunavut.
Well, it's definitely the Inuit are becoming global participants. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add, Kathy?
Yes, Canada already has signed agreements for edible seal products with Japan and South Korea. So we're keeping a very close eye onto those new markets, because other markets other than China are small compared to the large Chinese market. And at this time, only Canada has an agreement on edible seal products, and that will definitely be the Canadian Inuit in Nunavut that will take advantage of it. And I do want to say we intend to produce edible seal products for our benefit and for the rest of Canada to join us in marketing our edible seal products.
That was Kathy Totangi, president of the Nunavut Ngavik Incorporation. The Tribal Wiche-Waywin Capital Corporation is another step closer in its application for a judicial review of a $15.5 million federal government Aboriginal loan guarantee program. Gord McIntosh is the spokesperson, and he explains what's been happening in the legal push for a review.
We're talking here about a badly designed program, however well-intentioned. I mean, this is a program that gives subsidies in the form of loan guarantees to non-Aboriginal banks and credit unions in order to encourage lending to Aboriginal business. Okay, we don't have a problem with encouraging seed capital to finance Aboriginal business, but for the past 20 years, there have been Aboriginal financial institutions doing this mission. And now that something's starting to get going in the Aboriginal economy, it seems very unfair to simply hand it to mainstream lenders after the Aboriginal financial institutions had blazed a trail and started this. I mean, Aboriginal financial institutions were started 20 years ago with base capital of $200 million. They've now loaned out more than five times that amount to Aboriginal businesses and about 36,000 loans. This is a program that's been very successful. And, you know, you have to, I'd ask any Canadian business owner, how would you like it if the federal government was suddenly giving subsidies to your competitor? Obviously, you wouldn't be able to stay in business. If these subsidies to banks and credit unions continue, then the future for AFIs is rather limited. It's that simple. And it's something that we would argue is patently unfair. That's why we're seeking judicial review. That's basically it.
And so the court did tell them they needed to disclose the documents. And has that happened yet since September?
Yes. I mean, the documents were finally delivered in early January after all this time. And they're now being reviewed by legal counsel, and at some point they'll be into the public record as this case proceeds. And they are what we needed to finish the preparation of our case. And we hope that this can be resolved as quickly as possible.
Okay, so now you have the documents and lawyers are reviewing those, and what's the next step?
Well, since I'm not a lawyer, I can't say precisely, but it's all going to the aim of preparing for that day in court when it finally comes, and let's hope it's soon. And with the court's help, all sides can get down to coming up with a remedy that will work for everybody. Taxpayers, the government, Aboriginal people, and the lenders.
That was Gordon McIntosh, spokesperson for the Tribal Wiche'i Capital Corporation. Here's Derek Miller with Wishing Well from his CD, Dirty Looks.
All right, all you squares.
Wishing well, wishing I could break a spell, light another cigarette on the other side of sunset. Morning comes and you're not there. You never ever play me fair. Sitting on my wishing well, wishing I could break your spell. 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 Make me learn.
Nation Talks, Peter Jansen spoke with the new Director General of Aboriginal Entrepreneurship at Indian Northern Affairs Canada, Nicole Latassure, about her role.
Today I'm joined by Nicole Latassure of Indian Northern Affairs Canada. Nicole, thanks very much for joining Nation Talk.
My pleasure, Peter.
Nicole, I wanted to touch base, I guess, on, in particular, your team's efforts within the department. And if you could just provide a bit of an overview for the listeners of what activities you're engaged in and what you're hoping to do in your new role.
As a Director General for Aboriginal Entrepreneurship in the department, I'm part of a sector of lands and economic development, and I lead a team of people who work in three particularly important areas. One has to do with major projects, and we work with Aboriginal businesses. We also work with the private sector in setting up and creating investment funds on the one hand, but also supporting some greater projects, for instance, in the oil and gas sector or in the energy sector, like wind, those types of alternative energy. I also have another division that works what I call the SMEs, the small and medium-sized businesses, and that's all about creating businesses and helping them grow. And the third division that plays a key role as well has to do with procurement. And so it's one thing to build and create businesses, but of course procurement opportunities is also critically important. And so basically those are the three teams I lead. We also work closely with Aboriginal financial institutions as well in terms of giving them the levers through capitalization to work also with Aboriginal businesses.
Do you see any one particular area of the three that you mentioned that seems to be front and center or in a growth phase?
That's a very interesting question. I think that, in fact, I know they're all growing very feverishly at the same time. The program, I think...
That's good news.
Absolutely. Aboriginal business development, Aboriginal entrepreneurship is an extremely successful program. The demand far exceeds the resources we have, which is good news. But that demand is also pushing us to be much more creative and innovative in the way that we actually deliver the programs and how we work with Aboriginal businesses to ensure that the resources that are expended, you know, in fact create or have the greatest leverage, you know, in terms of producing results.
I realize that this is a relatively new role for you. You mentioned it was about 7 months now into your tenure. With fresh eyes, are there any things that you see that just seem to be really working for you or any changes recently that seem to be taking hold?
Well, we're here in Winnipeg to attend the Procurement Strategy for Aboriginal Business Conference. Mm-hmm. That's a conference we have once a year. Procurement is one of the key factors in terms of successful businesses. And back in the 90s, when the procurement strategy was set out, the purpose, of course, was to ensure that Aboriginal businesses had their fair share of government procurement. So what we're realizing now, though, of course, is that there's a huge, huge untapped potential in that whole procurement area. Provinces are coming to us to model their strategies on the federal government strategies, but in doing so, we're also creating partnerships with the provinces to ensure, again, that Aboriginal businesses have the greatest access possible to procurement. And we're also exploring how to establish increased connectivity with the private sector. So procurement isn't just about government procurement, but it's also about creating those business-to-business relationships that are so important. So there's an awful lot going on in the procurement area.
Would the procurement strategy for Aboriginal business be a focal point then for the government, do you feel?
Well, it certainly is, in the sense there's huge untapped potential in terms of procurement. It's an area that doesn't need a huge capital influx from a government perspective, because it's mostly about enabling, you know, creating an enabling environment that allows connections between business and government on the one hand and business to business on the other hand. And so these days, when we talk about austerity, and we all read the newspaper, and so we all know that we are through a difficult economic times, this is one program that can deliver, and that has the potential to deliver a lot more with very minimal investment in terms of funds.
You touched on private sector involvement and, I guess, kind of expanding the reach, I guess, if I can say as much, as well as engaging provincial government and trying to, I guess, get some type of uniformity or collection of minds together to ensure that the best practices are being employed and utilized. Would you see looking beyond the border at other areas or other best practices and with an eye to incorporating them into the federal strategy?
Absolutely. I think what we're trying to do in terms of procurement, because it's so important, we're trying to take a dual-track approach. And so we're looking at what we do in the very short term to increase that potential, to focus our efforts and yield a maximum of results. And so I talked about connectivity. I talked about establishing those linkages and other examples like that. From a longer-term perspective, we are looking at, what are the essential elements or the ingredients required to create, what we call a 21st century procurement strategy for Aboriginal business. And one of the things we are looking at is what role could incentives play, for instance, in terms of creating the mechanisms that would, in fact, interest non-Aboriginal businesses to procure from Aboriginal businesses or other governments, for instance. And so we are looking to other governments as well to see, in terms of the broader international landscape, what are some examples there. But we are doing a lot of internal thinking as well as part of our broader program renovation work.
That was Nation Talks' Peter Jensen speaking with Nicole Latassure, Director General of Aboriginal Entrepreneurship at Indian and Northern Affairs Canada. And that interview was courtesy of Nation Talk. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website, bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.